A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's question this week is about mutual intelligibility in the ancient Levant. He's been staring at the Israel Museum chart of Hebrew script evolution, and he noticed something that's easy to miss if you only know modern Hebrew. The letters we read today, the Asherite square script, are a latecomer. Before that, there was Paleo-Hebrew, and before the regional scripts split apart, they looked almost identical to Phoenician. So he's asking, was there a period when a Phoenician sailor, a Moabite merchant, and a Judean scribe could all read each other's writing the way a Swede and a Norwegian can read each other's newspapers today? And did that shared script actually shape how these societies dealt with each other, or was it just a happy accident of geography?
The answer to the first part is yes, and it's stronger than most people realize. For several centuries, these weren't separate alphabets at all. They were regional variants of one script, and the languages underneath were largely mutually intelligible Canaanite dialects. The word Paleo-Hebrew was only coined in 1954 by Solomon Birnbaum, and his whole argument was that calling the Hebrew script Phoenician was misleading, because it implies the Hebrews borrowed it from the Phoenicians, when really it was just the same script used by different peoples in different places.
So the naming problem is modern scholarship's problem, not an ancient problem.
Birnbaum said applying the term Phoenician to the script of the Hebrews is hardly suitable, but he wasn't claiming the scripts were different. He was claiming the people were different. The letter shapes are identical. The same Unicode block covers Paleo, Hebrew, Archaic Phoenician, Early Aramaic, Ammonite, Moabite, and Punic. You assign the name based on the language of the inscription, not the shape of the letters.
Which means a scribe from Tyre and a scribe from Jerusalem in, say, the 10th century before the Common Era were writing the same 22 letters in the same way.
And the languages were close enough that they could probably understand each other's speech, too. Paola Molo published a piece in Hebrew Bible and Ancient Israel a few years back that says Phoenician Punic and Hebrew have a certain, if not high, degree of mutual intelligibility. The Aramaic entry in the standard reference works. Lists Hebrew, Edomite, Moabite, Ekronite, and Phoenician as mutually intelligible Canaanite languages. This isn't the modern Latin analogy exactly. Daniel framed it as removing one point of friction, but the ancient case removed more friction, because the languages themselves were close relatives. Modern English and Polish share the Latin script, but an English speaker looking at Polish text understands nothing. A Judean looking at a Phoenician inscription in the 10th century was looking at letters he knew and words that mostly made sense.
So the better analogy is Scandinavia. Same script, languages close enough that reading across the border is slow but doable.
That's the right frame. And the practical proof is how modern scholars deciphered Phoenician. Early decipherers published Phoenician inscriptions using the square Hebrew block script. They just transcribed the letters into the Hebrew alphabet because the correspondence was so obvious. That practice continued until surprisingly recently. Nobody does that with scripts that are alien to each other.
You don't publish Etruscan in Greek letters.
Right, because Etruscan isn't Greek. But Phoenician and Hebrew were close enough that for a long time scholars treated them as interchangeable.
So when did this happy situation end?
The 9th century before the Common Era is the key divergence window. The Zayit stone and the Gezer calendar, both from the mid-10th century, are almost identical to the early Phoenician script on the Ahiram sarcophagus from the 9th century. But by the 8th century, you have distinct national alphabets. Israelite, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Phoenician, and Old Aramaic all have their own recognizable characteristics. Finkelstein and Sass argued Hebrew was the first regional variant to emerge in the late Iron IIa, and then the neighboring scripts developed their own distinct features up to a century later.
So Hebrew got its own handwriting first, and then everyone else followed.
That's the argument, and the timing tracks the rise of territorial states. Script divergence wasn't an accident. It was a consequence of political identity formation. Once you have a kingdom, you need a chancellery, and chancelleries develop their own house styles. Over generations, those house styles become national scripts.
Which flips Daniel's question on its head. He's asking whether shared script informed relations. The evidence suggests relations inform script.
That's the second order point. The shared script didn't prevent Israel, Judah, Moab, Phoenicia, and Aram from being frequent enemies. The Mesha Stele is from around 840 before the Common Era, written in Moabite, and it's a king boasting about defeating Israel. The Tel Dan Stele is old Aramaic from around 810, and it's probably an Aramean king claiming to have killed a king of Israel and a king of Judah. These people could read each other's writing, and they used it to celebrate killing each other.
The shared script was a tool, not a peace treaty.
And the divergence into national scripts tracked the political fragmentation. By the time the scripts looked different, the kingdoms were already rivals. The script change follows the politics, it doesn't drive it.
But there's a wrinkle. The languages stayed close even as the scripts drifted.
That's the distinction people miss. The script is the clothing, the language is the body. Moabite and Hebrew are known to be different languages not because the letters look different, but because of nuances of vocabulary, syntax, and pronunciation. A scholar looks at the Mesha Stele and says, this is Moabite, not because the letters are Moabite-shaped, but because the words are Moabite words. In the 9th century, the script was still mostly undifferentiated. The language was already marking the difference.
So a Moabite and a Judean could still read each other's inscriptions, but they noticed the other guy talked funny.
Right, like a Londoner reading a letter from Glasgow. Same alphabet, same language family, but the word choices and the inflections tell you immediately where the writer is from.
Now the biblical evidence Daniel might find interesting. There's a moment in 2 Kings where intelligibility is a live diplomatic issue.
2 Kings, 18:26. The Assyrian Rabshakeh is outside the walls of Jerusalem shouting threats in Hebrew, and the Judean officials ask him to speak Aramaic instead so the common people on the wall won't understand. The Assyrian refuses and keeps shouting in Hebrew.
Which tells us two things. The Judean elite understood Aramaic by the end of the 8th century, and the common people didn't.
And the Assyrian knew exactly what he was doing. He wanted the ordinary soldiers on the wall to hear the threats in their own language. Psychological warfare. The shared script and the closely related languages made that possible. If the Assyrian had been speaking something alien, the officials wouldn't have needed to ask him to switch.
So by the end of the 8th century, Aramaic was already the diplomatic lingua franca of the Near East.
It was becoming that. The Jewish Encyclopedia notes that 100 years before the Babylonian exile, Aramaic was understood only by people of culture in Jerusalem. The elites were bilingual, the masses were not. That's a very specific kind of mutual intelligibility, not universal, but concentrated at the top.
Which is different from the earlier Canaanite situation, where the languages were close enough that even ordinary people probably had some passive understanding across the border.
Probably, but we have to be careful. There's no surviving ancient testimony of a Phoenician merchant reading a Hebrew ostracon aloud. The direct evidence is inferential. We know the scripts were identical and the languages were close, so reading across the border must have been possible. But nobody wrote down, and then I read the Judean shipping manifest and it all made sense.
The absence of that kind of testimony is itself interesting. It suggests the reading across the border was so ordinary that nobody thought to remark on it.
That's my read. When something is completely normal, nobody writes about it. The fact that we have no ancient comment on cross-border script intelligibility suggests it was just part of the background noise of life in the Levant.
Now, the big shift. How did Hebrew end up in the square script we know today?
That's a story about empire. The Judeans in Babylonian exile kept using Old Hebrew script for Hebrew texts. We have labels on cuneiform tablets from Al-Yahudu, the Judean settlement in Babylonia, and they use Old Hebrew letters for Hebrew names. But when the Persians took over in 539, everything changed. The Persian Empire ran centrally managed chancelleries with strict Aramaic scribal training. The result was remarkable uniformity. Documents from Elephantine in Egypt and Bactria in Afghanistan, over 2,000 miles apart, are written in precisely the same way.
The Persians standardized the paperwork across the whole empire.
And the Judeans were inside that empire. They adopted the imperial Aramaic script for practical reasons. It was the language of administration, of commerce, of official communication. If you wanted to do business anywhere in the Persian world, you wrote in Aramaic script. The old Hebrew script became a local relic.
And then the relic became a theological problem.
This is the part I love. Joseph Nave called the Jewish abandonment of their own script an extraordinary phenomenon. A conservative nation that adhered to its traditional values abandoned its own script in favor of a foreign one. And the rabbis knew this was awkward. They had to explain why the Torah wasn't written in the original script anymore.
So they invented explanations.
The Babylonian Talmud, Sanhedrin 21b, says the Torah was originally given in Hebrew script and the holy language. But when the exiles returned in the days of Ezra, the Torah was given to them in Aramaic script and Aramaic language. Israel chose the Aramaic script and the Hebrew language, and left the Hebrew script and Aramaic language for the fools.
The fools being the Samaritans.
The Samaritans never adopted the Aramaic script. Their script is a direct continuation of Paleo-Hebrew, still used to this day. So the rabbis turned the script difference into a sectarian insult. The Samaritans kept the original script, and the rabbis called them fools for it.
That's a stunning inversion. The original script becomes the invalid one.
And it gets stranger. Rabbi Judah Hanasi in the Tosefta says the Torah was given in Aramaic script, then changed to Hebrew script when Israel sinned at the golden calf, then returned to Aramaic script when they merited again in the days of Ezra. He's trying to make the script change theologically palatable by claiming the Aramaic script was the original all along.
So the square script we read today is, according to that logic, the more authentic one.
And the Mishnah in Yadayim 4:5 rules that a Torah scroll written in Old Hebrew script doesn't defile the hands, meaning it's not sacred. Only a scroll written in Asherit, the Aramaic square script, is sacred. The script that's demonstrably older is declared non-sacred, and the script that was borrowed from a foreign empire is declared the only valid one.
That's the kind of thing that happens when you have to retrofit theology onto administrative convenience.
And the Dead Sea Scrolls show the tension. Some of them write the Tetragrammaton, the divine name, in Paleo-Hebrew letters while the rest of the text is in Aramaic script. The old script became a marker of special holiness, used only for the name of God, while the everyday sacred text was in the new script.
So the old script didn't disappear. It became a prestige marker.
It went through exactly that cycle. The Hasmonean coins use Paleo-Hebrew. The coins from the Great Revolt and the Bar Kokhba Revolt use Paleo-Hebrew. When you wanted to assert national identity against a foreign power, you reached for the old script. It was the script of the Davidic kingdom, the script of independence. Using it on coins was a political statement.
Which connects back to your earlier point. Script divergence tracked political identity, and script revival also tracked political identity.
The same script that united the Canaanite world became a marker of division. The Samaritans kept it and were mocked. The Jews abandoned it and then revived it for nationalist coinage. The script itself didn't change meaning, but the politics around it changed constantly.
So let's answer Daniel's question directly. Was there a point when other societies could read each other's scripts in this part of the ancient world?
Yes, and it lasted for centuries. From roughly the 10th century to the 8th century before the Common Era, the scripts of the southern Levant were essentially one script. A Phoenician, a Moabite, an Ammonite, and a Judean could all read each other's inscriptions without difficulty. And the languages underneath were close enough that they could understand most of the words too.
And did that intelligibility inform relations?
The evidence points the other way. Shared script didn't prevent war. The Moabites and Israelites wrote about killing each other in mutually readable script. The divergence into national scripts followed the political fragmentation. It didn't cause it. The shared script was a tool that everyone used, including for hostile purposes.
But the tool mattered. The Assyrian psychological warfare episode only works because the languages were close enough that the common people on the wall could understand the threats.
That's the nuance. The shared script and closely related languages meant that communication across borders was cheap. It didn't make people friends. But it meant that when they did interact, whether in trade, diplomacy, or war, they could understand each other without an interpreter. That's not nothing, it's just not peace.
The Latin analogy Daniel drew is useful but imperfect. Modern Latin script spans mutually unintelligible languages. The ancient Levantine situation was closer to Scandinavia. Same script, same language family, real but partial intelligibility.
And the ancient case had a dimension the modern one doesn't. The script itself became a political and religious marker. The Samaritans kept the old script and were condemned for it. The Jews adopted the imperial script and then declared it sacred. The old script became a nationalist symbol on coins. That's not how modern Latin script functions. Nobody in Poland writes in a special script to assert Polish identity against the Germans.
Well, they used to. The Fraktura versus Antiqua debate in Germany was exactly that kind of script. Nationalism.
Fair point. The Nazis banned Fraktura in 1941, calling it Jewish letters after having promoted it earlier. Script as identity marker is a recurring human behavior.
So the ancient Levant wasn't unique in politicizing script. It was just an early example.
And a particularly well-documented one because the rabbis wrote down their theological discomfort with the script change. We have the actual arguments they used to justify abandoning the original script. That's rare. Most script changes happen without anyone recording the rationalization.
The rationalization being the old script was for fools, the new script is sacred, and actually the new script was the original all along.
Three different explanations, all mutually contradictory, all preserved in the same tradition. That tells you how uncomfortable the change made them.
Now the Israel Museum chart Daniel mentioned. He's looking at the evolution of Hebrew scripts and noticing that at some points Hebrew looked almost like hieroglyphics.
The early forms do have a pictorial quality. The letter Aleph looks like an ox head, Bet looks like a house, Mem looks like water. The script started as pictographs and became increasingly abstract over time. By the time of the square script, the pictorial origins are completely gone. You'd never guess that Aleph was once an ox head.
So the evolution Daniel is seeing on that chart is a process of abstraction. The letters lose their pictures and become pure symbols.
That process happened differently in different places. The Phoenician script stayed closer to the early forms in some respects. The Hebrew script developed its own cursive tendencies. The Aramaic script became the basis for the square script we know today. Same starting point, different endpoints.
Which is why the chart is confusing if you don't know the political history. The letters didn't evolve in a straight line. They branched.
Then some branches died out while others were revived. Paleo-Hebrew fell completely out of use among Jews after the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135, but the Samaritans kept it alive and it's still used in Samaritan communities today. So the script that was declared non-sacred by the rabbis never actually died. It just moved to a different community.
The fools kept it alive.
The fools preserved the original script for 2,000 years. There's a lesson in that about who gets to write the history.
Let's talk about the scale of the evidence. How many inscriptions are we actually working with?
About 2,000 known Paleo-Hebrew inscriptions, and the vast majority are just a single letter or word. A seal impression here, a jar handle there. The big narrative texts are rare. Meanwhile, there are roughly 10,000 Phoenician Punic inscriptions, mostly formulaic, mostly from Carthage in the 3rd and 2nd centuries before the Common Era.
The Phoenician evidence is dominated by Carthage, which is far from the Levant.
Mostly formulaic, votive inscriptions, tomb markers, the kind of text that tells you a lot about formulas and very little about daily life. The Hebrew evidence is even thinner. We're working with fragments.
Which means the mutual intelligibility argument is built on a relatively small corpus.
It's built on the script identity, which is well established, and the language similarity, which is also well established. The direct evidence of someone reading across the border is missing, but the indirect evidence is strong. If the scripts are identical and the languages are close, reading across the border must have been possible. The only question is how much effort it took.
The answer is probably not much, at least in the early period.
In the 10th century, probably very little. By the 8th century, more, as the national scripts diverged. By the 5th century, the Judeans had switched to Aramaic script entirely, so the old shared script was no longer shared.
The window of easy mutual intelligibility was maybe 2 or 3 centuries.
Roughly. Long enough to matter, short enough to be missed if you're looking at the whole sweep of ancient history.
Daniel's question about whether intelligibility informed relations has a second layer. What about trade?
The Phoenicians were the great traders of the Mediterranean. They spread their script to Greece, to North Africa, to Spain. The Greeks borrowed the Phoenician alphabet and adapted it for their own language. That's the origin of the Greek alphabet, and from it the Latin alphabet, and from that the modern world's dominant script.
The script we're using right now descends from the same source as Paleo-Hebrew.
The Phoenician script is the ancestor of both Hebrew and Greek. The Hebrew branch went through Aramaic and became the square script. The Greek branch went through Etruscan and became Latin. Two descendants of the same script, now used by billions of people, looking nothing like each other.
That's the long view. The shared script of the ancient Levant didn't just enable mutual intelligibility for a few centuries. It seeded the writing systems of half the modern world.
The other half uses scripts that descend from Aramaic. The square Hebrew script, the Arabic script, the Syriac script, all go back to the Aramaic imperial standard. So the Persian Empire's bureaucratic standardization created the ancestor of most Middle Eastern and South Asian scripts.
The Persians didn't intend to create the Arabic script. They just wanted their paperwork to be consistent.
That's how it works. Administrative convenience becomes cultural inheritance. The Persian chancellery style became the basis for scripts used by hundreds of millions of people.
Which brings us back to Daniel's modern analogy. The worldwide dominance of the Latin alphabet today removes one point of friction between language groups. The ancient Levant had a similar situation, but it was local, temporary, and eventually replaced by imperial standardization.
The imperial standardization was more durable. The Aramaic script spread across the Persian Empire and then fractured into national scripts again. Arabic, Hebrew, Syriac, all descendants of the imperial standard, all mutually unintelligible today.
The cycle repeats. Shared script, political fragmentation, script divergence, new shared script, new fragmentation.
The script follows the politics every time.
My cousin worked in the script trade.
The script trade.
He was a sign painter in Haifa. 1972, he had a shop near the port. Painted names on boats. Hebrew, Arabic, Greek, Russian. Whatever the captain wanted. He said the letters were the easy part. The hard part was getting the spacing right on a curved hull.
That's a very specific skill.
He could paint a Hebrew aleph and an Arabic aleph and a Greek alpha and tell you they were all the same letter. Same ox head, he said, just turned different ways over 3,000 years. He had a chart on the wall showing the whole family tree. Aleph, aleph, alpha, bet, ba, beta. He said any fool could see they came from the same place.
Did he think the ancient people knew they were reading the same script?
He said the Phoenicians knew. They were the ones selling it. A Phoenician merchant in the 10th century could write his accounts in his own script and read a Hebrew jar label and a Moabite monument and never think of them as different alphabets. He said the differences were like a man from Haifa and a man from Acre writing the same Arabic. You can tell which one wrote it, but you can read both.
That matches what the paleography shows. The national scripts only separated later.
My cousin said the separation was politics. Once the kings wanted their own script, the scribes made it happen. He said the scribes were the real power. They could make a letter look royal or common, sacred or profane, just by how they drew the serif.
Your cousin had opinions.
He was a sign painter. He thought about letters all day. He said the rabbis who called the old script invalid were doing what all bureaucrats do, defending the paperwork they were trained on. The old script was for the Samaritans, who were the competition, so the old script had to be wrong.
That's a cynical read, but it matches the Tosefta. The theological justification came after the administrative change.
My cousin said that theology was always after the fact. First you change the script because the empire requires it. Then you invent a reason why the new script is the sacred one. He said it was the same with the Latin Mass. First, the Vatican changed the language, then they wrote the justification.
He was a sign painter with strong views on Vatican II.
He painted the signs for a church in Haifa. Got into an argument with the priest about whether the Greek letters on the iconostasis should be painted in the old style or the new style. The priest wanted the old style. My cousin said the old style was just the new style from 100 years earlier. The priest didn't like that.
Your cousin was right about that. The old style is always just the new style from 100 years earlier.
He said the only people who care about script purity are the ones who have something to gain from it. The rest of us just want to read the sign.
That's probably the cleanest summary of the whole episode.
He was a smart man, drank too much, not to be trusted about anything involving money. But he knew his letters.
The sign painter's view of script evolution. It's actually a useful corrective. The scholarly literature focuses on the political and theological dimensions. The practical reality was probably closer to what your cousin described. People wrote what they needed to write in whatever script was current and didn't think much about it.
Until someone told them the script mattered.
That's when the trouble started.
The one thing I'm taking from this is that the shared script of the ancient Levant was real. It lasted for centuries, and it made cross-border reading easy, but it didn't make people friends. The script followed the politics, not the other way around. And when the politics changed, the script changed, and then the theology was invented to justify the change.
The sharpening line is this. The script that was declared sacred was the borrowed one, and the script that was declared invalid was the original. If you want to understand how script and identity work, that inversion tells you everything.
We're going to leave it there. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the sign painter.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast. If you want to send us your own prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.